I slept too little and drank too much.
Whose idea was this anyway? Get out of bed like this. Oh, Christ.
Rise and shine with CKUT 90.3 FM.
Prison Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.cqut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@cqut.ca.
Listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Candace, and I'm your host for today's show. On today's show, we will be featuring an interview by Submedia.tv with Melvin Ray of the Free Alabama Movement. Melvin talks with the Stimulator about the upcoming strike in U.S. prisons set to begin on September 9th on the 45th anniversary of the uprising at Attica Penitentiary in 1971. We will also be airing the first two parts of an interview with Diana Block, who has been a radical activist since the 1970s. She was a founding member of San Francisco Women Against Rape, the Prairie Fire Organizing Committee, the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, and the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoners. But first, some news items. As of August 23rd, according to a letter from hunger striker LaRon McKinley, the hunger strike against solitary confinement at the Wappan Correctional Institution in Wisconsin has become a serious health crisis after 76 days. Officials at the prison stopped force-feeding McKinley and Cesar De Leon, the two most committed hunger strikers, only to tube-feed them again 72 hours later. Supporters are denouncing this dangerous practice and calling for more outside support. For more information, you can visit solitarytorture.blogspot.com. As of August 24th, Palestinian prisoner Bilal Kayed has announced that he is suspending his hunger strike on his 71st day without food. More information is forthcoming in a press conference, and we will continue to report on Bilal's struggle against administrative detention here on the Prison Radio Show. According to a Globe and Mail article on August 18th, a judge in Alberta has freed three federal prisoners from segregation cells. The judge concluded that prison officials ignored factors around procedural fairness, Aboriginal identity, and mental health history before isolating them. The prisoners were representing themselves in the case. And so up next here on the Prison Radio Show, we will hear the interview with Melvin Ray. It was conducted by folks at Submedia. You should be warned that there is strong language in this piece. There is the F word said about half a dozen times near the beginning of the interview.
Good morning, slaves. This September 9th marks the 45th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising, where inmates took control of the New York penitentiary to demand political rights and better living conditions.
We want to apply the New York State minimum wage law to all state institutions. We want to stop to slave labor here. We want to allow all New York State prisoners to be politically active without intimidation or reprisals.
On the anniversary of this inspiring event, inmates from all over the United States are planning the largest motherfucking prison strike in history to demand an end to legalized slavery. So, to learn a bit more about what the fuck's going down, I recently caught up with Melvin Ray, a member of the Free Alabama Movement and an inmate at Holman Prison in Alabama, who at great risk to himself spoke to us via Skype from the guts of the prison. Hey Melvin, how the fuck are you?
Hey, I'm miserable, man. I'm miserable, but we're making it in here. We're doing okay.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty of the upcoming prison strike, we are speaking to you via Skype from inside the prison in what I suppose is a means of communication not approved by your jailers. Are you taking any kind of risk by doing this? So what the fuck's going down on September 9th?
Well, we're planning nationwide work strikes. We're trying to bring awareness to the issues of mass incarceration, prison slavery, the 13th Amendment. And we're getting people politically involved in the process of us taking control of our own destinies and being responsible for some of the changes that we are aware of that need to be made.
How has the strike been organized, and what sort of repression have organizers been facing?
Well, it's really different from place to place because we're in so many different states, and people are organizing in so many different ways. For those of us who are more in the social media arena, going and doing, you know, things like this right here, we're easier to find because the social media puts us out there. So we experience different types of things. They come and, you know, try to shut off our lines of communication, put us in places inside the prison where we can't communicate. But on the ground, the guys, you know, our roles as far as being out front really is to get the message out for the main organizers in the other places, the other prisons, to help get the word out for people who really don't have the ability to use social media or other forms. Their communications are restricted, so we know that there are consequences involved in what we're doing, but we embrace that.
Prisons in the United States are often informally segregated along racial lines in an effort to keep inmates from joining together to throw down against the screws. How has this dynamic affected organizing efforts, and what have peace been doing to overcome it?
Again, you know, you're dealing with different sections of the country. You know, like here in Alabama, the prison system is probably, I would say, 70% African-American. And then when you go out west or something like that, you have all the different racial groups. You have the African-Americans, you have the Hispanics, the Mexicans, you have the whites, you have the foreigners. So we don't really deal, we don't have that as a core issue here in Alabama. So I can't really speak for how it affects people in other parts of the country. And that was something that we actually had to get aware of, just understanding that every prison system is not constructed in the same way that the Alabama prison system is. So that's not that's not an issue that we have a lot of problems with.
One of the main demands of the September 9th strike is the end of slavery. What the fuck do peeps mean by this?
A lot of people are not really even conscious of what the 13th Amendment actually says. A lot of people think that the 13th Amendment abolished slavery in this country. But that's just simply what we were told. And as far as being a descendant of former slaves, the 13th Amendment, we were not even allowed to read the book. You know, we were told this is what it says. And so when you actually go back and read the 13th Amendment and read it for yourself, you'll see that it does not even say that it abolished slavery. It says there are exceptions within that clause for people who have been convicted of crimes. And so for us, we understand that the only way that you can be duly convicted of a crime is if you go into the criminal justice system. And so the criminal justice system became stewards of the enterprise of slavery. And just to put that in context, prior to the 13th Amendment, there was private citizen ownership of slaves. But after the 13th Amendment was ratified in this country, the institution of slavery was taken away from private owners, and then it was taken under the control of the states. And so, therefore, the system of slavery is the system of Department of Corrections. And that's what the law says. And so when we say we're striving to abolish slavery, we understand that the industries that men and women who are incarcerated, we produce billions and billions of dollars each year for companies like Walmart, McDonald's, Wendy's, John Deere, Victoria's Secret. We answer call centers for AT&T and Verizon. We make eyeglasses, dentures, and all of these different varieties of products. And these corporations that are using this slave labor, this prison labor, they finance political action committees. They finance politicians. They make sure that people are in office who will pass the kind of laws that they need passed to gain access to this free labor pool. And so when you look at the overall system, you realize that it's nothing but a corporation. It is a corporation that's based off of the same principles that slavery was before the 13th Amendment, except for there are different people in control, and it all runs through the state now. So that's what we say when we want to abolish prison slavery, is that we want to take the exploitation and the economics out of prisons and make prisons be what they're supposed to be about, which is education, rehabilitation, and reentry preparedness, and not economics.
What types of jobs are prisoners doing, and what corporations are involved?
We make furniture. We make some of the furniture you're sitting on very well could be made by someone. The glasses that you have on, we make glasses. Dentures. People have dentures in their mouth. We make dentures. For McDonald's, when you go and place an order at McDonald's, that uniform that the worker has on is probably made by someone who is incarcerated. The meat patty that you have, we run cattle ranches all around the country. We make meat patties, frozen meats, fresh meats. We run cattle farms where we milk cows, and the milk in your refrigerator very well could have been made by someone who is incarcerated. Car parts, you name it. And on the federal side, see, the military, the night vision goggles, the uniforms, the boots, you know, all of these products are made by people who are incarcerated, because once we be convicted and put into the prison system, then we become property of the state, and the state uses us to balance their budgets. You know, when there are layoffs around the country, those jobs are still required. You still have to do those jobs. When a city or state government has a mass layoff because of budget issues, recession or whatnot, those jobs still have to be done. And that's when they tap into the prison labor system. So a lot of people around the country, they may have lost a state job or federal job and didn't realize that job was turned over to someone who was incarcerated. There have been many factories that have been closed down that make the American flag, furniture companies and whatnot here in Alabama. Those jobs were brought into the prison system. And so that's how it works. They use us as part of the budget. You know, we literally balance the budget for states and the federal government around the country.
You're a member of the Free Alabama Movement, a prisoner network that has led a series of mounting coordinated strikes in 2014. How did y'all start, and how are you organized?
The Free Alabama Movement, we're a civil and human rights organization, and we're fighting against mass incarceration alongside with all of the other people. We have a three-point strategy that we organize around. Our first strategy is we organize the labor inside of the prison. And it's not just work strikes. It's also boycotts. We boycott the phone companies. We boycott the canteen. These are no-bid contracts with kickbacks embedded within the contracts that are all legal under, you know, these laws. And so we organize work strikes and boycotts at the same time on the inside. On the outside, we organize family members to conduct protests on the outside of prisons. We specifically emphasize that we want the protests at the prisons, because this is where the issues are. This is where the people are incarcerated. And so this is where we want the activism, and this is where we want the energy and the people. And the third thing we do is we identify companies that use prison labor, and we expose those companies by having protests at those companies. So we organize our supporters and activists on the outside to go to these companies. We've been successful in organizing a nationwide campaign against McDonald's. And when we go to McDonald's, we don't just protest against McDonald's. We use companies like McDonald's to allow us to use that platform that they have to get the message out about all of the other companies. So when you go to Starbucks, the cup that you're drinking your lattes and smoothies from, that cup was made by someone who was incarcerated. And so we'll go to Starbucks, and we'll go to some of these other companies in the future. But that's what Free Alabama Movement does. And then we reached out to various organizations. IWOP actually came into existence from interacting with us. And we've been able to spread this freedom charter around the country to Free Mississippi Movement, Free Ohio Movement, Free Virginia Movement, the New Underground Railroad, which runs the Free California Movement for us. And so this is what the Free Alabama movement is doing. We're trying to organize a movement around the same fundamentals around the country. And the work strikes are very important to that.
What can peeps on the outside do to lend their support to the strike?
What we would ask is that people who are interested to organize a demonstration at either one or two places, either at a place of confinement, it can be the county jail, the city jail in your city. It can be at a prison that's in your community, or it can be at a detention facility. Anywhere where there are human beings who are suffering under the 13th Amendment mass incarceration, that's where we want our organizers and supporters at. Second thing they can do is they can organize at a corporation that uses prison labor. And finally, you can support the people who are on the inside. We're going to be under a tremendous amount of repression. You know, we need people to make phone calls, to call in and demand answers for why people are being targeted, because these are nonviolent and peaceful protests. We do not advocate violence. We do not advocate destruction of property. We probably should advocate for the destruction of property, but we don't, because what we're trying to do is demonstrate to society that the message that they're receiving about us is wrong. They're telling you all that we're violent, that we're not fit for return to society, that we're irrational and impulsive thinkers. And so this is what these demonstrations are about. It affords us an opportunity to put the truth out and expose the lies that are being fed to the public to justify this multi-billion dollar corporation that's enriching the same politicians and judges and people, prosecutors, and these forensics, laboratory scientists, people who are all corrupted by the revenue that's being made from prison. So that's how we would ask for assistance.
Thanks, Melvin. And that about does it for this edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. For links to the Free Alabama Movement and the September 9th strike, just visit my fucking website, stimulator.tv.
And you are listening to the Prison Radio Show here on SKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at skut.ca. That was Melvin Ray of the Free Alabama Movement. He spoke with the Stimulator about the upcoming strike in U.S. prisons, set to begin on September 9th on the 45th anniversary of the uprising at Attica Penitentiary, 1971. And next here on the show, we are going to hear from Diana Block. She has been a radical activist since the 1970s. She was a founding member of San Francisco Women Against Rape, the Prairie Fire Organizing Committee, the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, and the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoners. She is the author of the memoir Arm the Spirit, A Woman's Journey Underground and Back, as well as the novel Clandestine Occupations, An Imaginary History. She lives in San Francisco with her life partner, former political prisoner Claude Marx. And in the first part of this interview, Diana talks about organizing in the 1970s. So, by the way, the time is 11:18 here on SKUT.
Can you start by telling us a bit of your story? How did you get involved in the early organizing that you were doing? And is there a point at which you realized your worldview had changed in some fundamental way?
Oh, sure. So I came of age in the 60s and 70s. So, of course, there was a lot going on that was life-changing in general. But as with everybody, there's always a particular entry point, and mine really came through the women's movement. I was really involved in racial justice type of activities and other types of support work, but I don't think I really kind of understood the way in which those issues were interconnected with myself, and so I became involved as a feminist. And somehow that opened my consciousness. I began to see the world through a political lens, rather than just seeing different isolated or problematic issues. And so that was my first, I would say, big worldview shift. And then the second one had to do with when I started I moved from New York to California, and very early on I got involved with other women who were doing solidarity work with women in Vietnam. And that really was a big shift for me as well, because at that point I began to understand some of the kind of American chauvinist ways in which the U.S. feminist movement was operating. And I began to really understand the issue of women's liberation in an international context, which was very important in terms of challenging a lot of types of white supremacist and U.S.-centric notions of what feminism was about. And then I would say the third major shift was when I became involved and part of the founding of the Prairie Fire Organizing Committee, which was a radical organization founded in 1975. It was primarily a white organization that was saw itself as acting in solidarity with Third World Liberation Movements. And becoming involved with that, I really took a step into dedicating my political work and my life to revolutionary anti-imperialism is the way we termed it at the time. And I really began seeing my political work in relationship to national liberation movements around the world, and also understanding at that point that the ways in which revolution was made wasn't just about public activity, but could very justifiably involve types of underground activity as well, as was being led by people all around the world, in Vietnam and Cuba and Nicaragua and all through Southern Africa. Those were all examples at the time. So that also shifted my understanding of sort of what my responsibilities, at least in that era, were as a white anti-imperialist feminist woman.
So it sounds like you traveled through a bunch of different maybe ideologies, maybe movements, depending on how you want to think about them. And I think because this is the Prison Radio Show, we're going to end up trying to talk about how prisoner justice or prisoner support or political prisoner support relates to all of that kind of stuff. So do you want to talk a little bit about how you got involved in prisoner justice or prisoner support or political mm-hmm. prisoner support, and also what you call it when you do that kind of work and why you call it that?
Sure. Of course, how I started in the 70s is, you know, somewhat different than now, or you know, it's evolved in different ways. So just to be clear, in the 70s, my political work was not centered on prison justice work. I mean, as that was the advantage at that point in time of being part of a political organization that did a lot of different types of work, and therefore different people did different, you know, dedicated themselves to different aspects. So, however, as part of Prairie Fire, I was very active in general solidarity with prisoners, particularly prisoners at San Quentin. One of the very long-time political prisoners, whom I think your listeners are familiar with, was Julio Muntakim, and he had been arrested in 1971, and he was at San Quentin in the latter part of the 70s. And he was putting out, he was one of a collective that put out a newspaper called Arm the Spirit. And Prairie Fire, the organization I was part of, was the support network on the outside for publishing that that newspaper. And so I was definitely, I didn't myself do the layout, but I was part of distribution and of studying the articles that were written in Arm the Spirit. And I did do some visiting at San Quentin, although not all the time. I also did some visiting in that in the 70s of the women's prison in Southern California, CIW. And that came about actually through the work I was part of around women in Vietnam. Because we had a slideshow and a presentation, and we went into the prison, which at that time, no longer would that be possible, but at that time was open to groups coming in with pretty radical politics and making presentations. And so we were able to go into the women's prison and make a presentation about the struggle in Vietnam and how women were winning their liberation part of that. So so that was my early kind of relationship to prison solidarity work. And in terms of what to call it, I mean, I guess I would call it prisoner solidarity work, but nowadays it's part of a more of a general abolitionist framework of wanting to kind of abolish the prison industrial complex altogether as we know it.
So my next question is, do you think about your decision to go underground as a decision to support prisoners? And if so, why?
I wouldn't say that that's how we primarily saw our decision to go underground. We saw the decision to go underground as part of solidarity with the Puerto Rican independence movement, the Black liberation movement, Native movement, with the movements as a whole. Now, at the same time, we knew, I mean, those movements had been under serious attack. Many people had been imprisoned as a result of COINTELPRO and other types of related attacks. And we understood that part of the mission or aspect of solidarity was in relationship to supporting prisoners because they were the freedom fighters in those liberation movements. So definitely our decision was connected, or we saw work in connection. But it wasn't, that wasn't the way we framed it, per se. However, also at that time, some of the most leading political actions that were being undertaken by clandestine groups were in relationship to prisoners. So in 1979, sure, couple of years before I went underground, Assata Shakur was liberated from prison. And shortly before Assata was liberated, Guillermo Morales, who was freedom fighter in the Puerto Rican independence movement, was liberated. I mean, he liberated himself, but then he had help afterwards. From prison, from Bellevue in New York City. So, Bellevue Hospital. So, clearly, those were actions that were very significant and kind of raised the possibilities of what type of solidarity and support work a group that was underground could undertake. So, those examples were definitely in our consciousness when we went underground. So, I don't know. I guess it's a yes and no answer. Definitely, prison solidarity was very linked to our purpose in going underground, but the overall definition was more about the liberation movement as a whole.
And that was part of an interview with Diana Block, who is a founding member of San Francisco Women Against Rape, the Prairie Fire Organizing Committee, the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, and the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoners. Next, here in the second part of the interview, Diana talks about living underground and relating to changing ideas around crime in the U.S. in the 1990s. She also talks about how having a partner in prison affected her ideas about prison.
In Arm the Spirit, which is your memoir, you talk about watching America's Most Wanted, like right from when the show started, every Saturday night. And you talk about worrying that they would run a story on the show about you and your comrades who were underground with you. And you were also underground during a time of big increases in the prison population in the U.S. I haven't exactly looked up the numbers, but I know between the 80s and 90s, the prison population in the U.S. skyrocketed. And I was wondering if you have insights or thoughts about how ideas around crime and punishment were changing during this time period.
Oh, yes. I mean, that it was a period of a very, very dramatic change. And, of course, when we were living through it, we could see aspects of it, but didn't really understand the immensity, in a certain sense, of the changes that were going on. Until later, looking back on it. America's Most Wanted is a good example of that. I mean, we had, when we were, before we went underground, we were very much both working in solidarity with prison struggles and also had undertaken some analysis of how the law and order movement, as we framed it at the time, was really trying to develop a popular base, mainly among white people, for support for the police, for turning in other people, for sort of just basically organizing communities in alliance with the police and law enforcement rather than in, you know, alliance with each other. And so we had done some of that analysis prior to going underground. So, but then when we began watching, I mean, we had a very immediate and personal interest in America's Most Wanted because we were very worried that our story was going to be featured, which it eventually was, and that was definitely jeopardized us and our security. So we were very attentive, let's say, to the program. But we also tried to understand it in a more general socio-political sense. And it was really pretty horrifying because, and you know, I think it's hard to kind of paint the picture of what it looked like now when reality TV and crime TV is so mainstreamed and everyday, and people, I mean, may not like it, but they, you know, it's not innovative at all. But this was, at the time, innovative. I mean, it's important to understand that this was not the type of programming that had been happening before, where you kind of involve people directly through these TV program with catching criminals, so-called. I mean, today it would be catching, or it is catching terrorists. But So to us, that was a big development politically. And I think that that was a right assessment, that it really was a big deal, a shift. I mean, and now it's become all-encompassing in terms of the degree to which programs like that are just assimilated into the media and everyone's consciousness of how people are caught. So that was one very big signifier in terms of a shift around criminalization and massification of law and order ideology. At the same time, we were aware that this, the so-called the drug war, was escalating, that there were all these connections to, everyone was aware of the Iran-Contra scandal and the ways in which the war in Nicaragua. I mean, I shouldn't say everyone, but there was a political awareness on the left of the way in which the Contras were being used to actually funnel drugs into black communities. And so we could see, and then at the same time as the laws were getting more and more draconian in terms of the ways in which people with drugs were being prosecuted. So we could see those types of changes and note them. But I don't think it wasn't really until the mid-90s where sort of the full extent of the impact of the shift in drug laws became more evident, and that we were really began to understand, along with a lot of other people, progressive people, how much this was not, it had kind of qualitatively changed to a situation where instead of just targeting leaders or leading organizations, which was how COINTELPRO operated, that now there was this whole prison industrial complex structure that was targeting entire communities of color for internment, and that all of that was really a response to the level of revolutionary and activity that had occurred, and the threat which the U.S. state saw in the activities of the Panthers and the AIM and the Puerto Rican independence movement, so that they had to develop a more comprehensive strategy in order to contain that potential for upsetting the racist status quo.
So I feel like there's a few shifts that you're mentioning here, and I'm curious if and how much they factored into you and your comrades' decision to resurface in the mid-90s. So you're talking about this law and order shift that's sort of characterized through shows like America's Most Wanted, and then there's also this shift in terms of the drug war and policies around imprisonment in the U.S. that are imprisoning more and more people and, in fact, like targeting whole communities. Did watching those two shifts happen and recognizing how much they were solidifying impact your decision to resurface in 1996?
Yes, in certain ways. Although I wouldn't say that was the main factor. It was like in combination. I think the problem, or what we recognized, was that most of the forces that we had gone underground in solidarity with had been devastated mainly by COINTELPRO and related imprisonment strategies over the time that we were, after we had gone underground. and that we were, there no longer were other forces that we could really work with in a what we considered a good political way. And our own situation was so precarious that we really spent most of our time concentrating on not getting caught, which is really a terrible thing as a political activist to dedicate your life to. But, I mean, we didn't want to get caught, and that's for different reasons, because we saw that most of the people that we were, had been, you know, comrades with many of the people who ended up as political prisoners, Alan Berkman, David Gilbert, Laura Whitehorn, Linda Evans, Marilyn Buck. I mean, there's a lot of other white anti-imperialists who ended up in prison and had, like, decades-long sentences. So we didn't want to, that didn't seem like a good outcome for what we were about. So we did take a lot of care in many different ways, as much as we could, not to get caught, even though we did also figure out ways to try and act on a certain progressive political level, because we were all political people and we didn't want to just be spending our lives, you know, worrying about security. So we didn't want to get caught, and yet we didn't see a long-term path, political path, for us underground. Of course, personally, it was terrible also, but we really did not see how to change the structure of our lives given what the political realities were. And so we did investigate, and finally we were able to figure out how to return in a way that was principled. I mean, that was the big problem with the unknown factor is that we thought, which some groups at the time didn't think was right, although actually there was a shift by the time we came back to public life, you know, that there shouldn't ever be any type of deal with the police or the state. But we felt like that was too rigid a definition, because right as we were living, we were not accomplishing anything. So, but we really were adamant and that we would not be complicit in giving information or cooperating or anything like that. So we needed to come up with some type of a negotiation that meant that we wouldn't have to cooperate. And amazingly, and it is pretty amazing looking back at it, we were able to do that. You know, there are probably many different reasons that was true. A couple of people from our collective had to do time, and that was part of the deal. But it was a much more limited than many other people had to do, and we were able to return. So, yeah, it was mainly the desire to continue being political activists that was motivating in our return.
So when you and your comrades returned in the mid-90s, two people in your group were sentenced to not so many, but a few years in prison on charges of supporting an escape attempt for Puerto Rican political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera. I'm wondering if your ideas about prison and prisoner solidarity changed once you had a more personal connection to people inside, and or did you feel like you had more personal connections to folks inside at this time? And then additionally, can you update us about the current political struggle to free Oscar Lopez Rivera, because he's still inside today?
Yes. So, yes, we were the two members of our group, my partner, Claude Mark, and my very good friend and comrade, Donna Wilmot, were both convicted, or they were, they didn't have a trial, but by the terms of our negotiation, they were sentenced to a certain number of years. Claude served 4, and Donna served 2. And yeah, having them in prison absolutely transformed my relationship to prisons in general. I mean, as I had talked about, I had visits before. We were very aware of prisoners inside, but, you know, having a member of your family, and in my case, the father of my 2 kids, was very life-changing on an emotional, psychological level, and also in terms of the insights that it gave me into the prison system as a whole, the way it is operated with family members, the way family members are treated sort of as an extension of the prisoner and are intimidated, harassed, humiliated on a regular basis in relationship to their loved ones. I think in terms of my ideas about prisoner support, I mean, I began to see it on a multi-dimensional, multi-leveled way. And at that point, I think there were different influences, but I really began to feel like you couldn't separate political prisoners from everyone else who was in prison. I mean, there were differences, and I know an ongoing debate, but I believe that people who, you know, consciously make political choices, that then they end up being put in prison as a result of those political choices and those political actions, there's a distinction in terms of who they are. And also people who then become radicalized in prison and then suffer consequences because of their radical positions and actions once they are in prison. And, you know, it's hard. It's not a hierarchy. It's not like these are better people or exactly. I just think that there's an importance to movements supporting people who are actively fighting. There's also an importance for movements supporting people who are targeted because of primarily their race, their economic stature, their gender, and end up in prison because of all those political factors. And that is the connection that I began to see at the time was really critical to make. And I think only now is it really becoming a connection that is more generally made. I feel like for years there was a real separation between the parts of the political movement in the U.S. anyway, I don't know how it is in Canada, that did solidarity work political prisoners and the parts of the movement that were working against the prison industrial complex and in solidarity with prisoners who did not come into the prison system because of their political consciousness or activity. And yet they really are, in my mind, in my experience, very closely linked, and I think they're very much have to be tackled together. So I feel like now that those connections are beginning to be made, they've been made by various groups from time to time, but in a more wide-scale way. I, you know, was really excited for many, many reasons, but the vision for Black Lives that just came out, the policy platform that was released by the Movement for Black Lives, really does make some of those connections in a really important way.
That was Diana Block, a radical activist and author who spoke to the Prison Radio Show about her experiences underground in the 80s and 90s, as well as her prisoner solidarity organizing since the 1990s. So far, we've aired three parts of our interview with Diana Block here on the Prison Radio Show, and more parts will be featured in upcoming shows. In the meantime, you can check out her memoir titled Arm the Spirit, A Woman's Journey Underground and Back, and her fiction novel, Clandestine Occupations, an Imaginary History. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month here on SKUT 90.3 FM. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Thursday, September 8th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions or on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the program, you can contact us at prison@skut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. People can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. And if you are in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. You can write to us at The Prison Radio Show, or you could simply write PRS on the envelope, care of CKUT 3647, University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. And so thank you for tuning into The Prison Radio Show here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Candace, and I've been your host for today's show. We're going to leave you with a song by Heron Scott, We Beg Your Pardon, about the Attica Uprising. And you want to stay tuned because Butcher T's Noontime Cuts is on at the top of the hour here on CKUT.
We'd like to do an idea for you that was related to the H2O GATE Watergate Blues. In March of 1973, we wrote the Watergate Blues, and some 17 months later, then President Nixon resigned. But the story didn't end there, and so we didn't stop there. We have prepared a sequel, and it's called We Beg Your Pardon, America. We beg your pardon because the pardon you gave this time was not yours to give. They call it due process, and some people are overdue. We beg your pardon, America. Somebody said, brother man gonna break a window, gonna steal a hubcap, gonna smoke a joint, brother man gonna go to jail. The man who tried to steal America is not in jail. Get caught with a nickel bag, brother man. Get caught with a nickel bag, sister lady, on your way to get your hair fixed. You'll do Big Ben, and Big Ben is time, but a man who tried to fix America will not do time. Said they're gonna slap his wrist, gonna retire him with $850,000, and America was shocked. America leads the world in shocks. Unfortunately, America does not lead the world in deciphering the cause of shock. $850,000, they said, and the people protested, so they said, all right, we'll give him $200,000. Everybody said, okay, that's better. I'd like to retire with $200,000 someday. San Quentin, not San Clemente. Do not pass go, go directly to jail. Do not collect $200,000. We beg your pardon, America. We beg your pardon because somehow the pardon did not sit correctly. What were the causes for this pardon? Well, now, they had flea biters. Rats bite us, no pardon in the ghetto. They had national security. But do you feel secure with a man who tried to steal America back on the streets again? What are the results of this pardon, though? Because remember, when there's causes, there's results. And the results is always deeper still. We now have Oatmeal Man. Anytime you find someone in the middle, anytime you find someone who is tepid, anytime you find someone who is lukewarm, anytime you find someone who has been in Congress for 25 years and no one ever heard of him, you've got Oatmeal Man. Oatmeal Man straddling uncomfortably yards and feet of barbed wire. It's hard to live in the middle all the time. Oatmeal Man, the man who said you could fit all of his black friends in the trunk of his car and still have room for the Republican elephant. Oatmeal Man. But there was no crime committed. Oatmeal Man says that America, in 1975, your president will be a 1913 Ford. Regressive. Circle up the wagons to defend yourself from nuclear attack. Oatmeal Man. Reminiscent of 1964's AUH2O Goldwater. Thank God he didn't win. But Oatmeal Man didn't win. Did you vote for him? I didn't vote for him. But that's the first result. And the second would be the Dread Rockefeller. Doubtlessly being promoted for the job he did at Attica. 43 dead and millions of Americans once again in shock. Doubtlessly being promoted for the job he did on the streets of New York City, where the pushers sell the drugs that the government allows in the country, and then they do time. They do life and death, or life and death behind bars, while William Saxby says he's going to dismiss the Lorton Furlough Program. And Brother Richard X of Buffalo, New York, faces 1,365, did he say 1,365 years behind bars for participating in Attica. And Rockefeller faces being the vice president of this country, and all is calm and quiet along the white sands at San Clemente. We beg your pardon, America. We beg your pardon once again. Because we found out that 7 out of every 10 black men behind jail, and most of the men behind jail are black. 7 out of every 10 black men never went to the ninth grade, didn't have $50 and hadn't had $100 for a month when they went to jail. So the poor and the ignorant go to jail while the rich go to San Clemente. We beg your pardon, America, because we understand now much more deeply than we understood before. But we don't want to take the pardon back. We want to issue some more. Pardon Brother Frank Willis, the Watergate security guard. He was only doing his job. Pardon H. Rapp Brown. It was only burglary. Pardon Robert Vesco. It was only embezzlement. Pardon Charles Manson. It was only mass murder. And pardon us while we get sick. Because they pardoned William Calley, 22 dead, and America in shock. And we understand all the more deeply, and we beg your pardon. As unemployment spirals towards 7%, and it seems like 70% in my neighborhood, as unemployment spirals and as we watch cattlemen on TV shoot cows in the head and kick them in the graves while millions are starving in the Sahel and the Honduras and maybe even next door, we understand all the more deeply as Boston becomes Birmingham, becomes Little Rock, becomes Selma, becomes Philadelphia, Mississippi, becomes yesterday all over again. We understand and we beg your pardon. We beg your pardon, America, because we have an understanding of karma. What goes around comes around.
Now, this is Angela Davis. You're listening to CKUT 90.3.
Angela, you're one of a million. Yeah.